All right, y'all, welcome to the show. How's it going? It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I got a pretty good show lined up for you today, I think. Phil Giraldi's going to be here from antiwar.com, the American conservative magazine. Former CIA counterterrorism officer. Also, Chris Floyd will not be on the show. I promised he would be, and apparently it turns out that was a lie. But don't worry, Chris Floyd will be here tomorrow, so that's almost as good. But James Bamford's going to be here, author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory. Oh, yes, it's a very important and valuable thing when James Bamford writes something. Check out his articles in Rolling Stone, too. The Man Who Sold the War, for one example. Check out the Nova special, not PBS Frontline, but PBS Nova, the science show, about the science of the FBI and National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of you. Oh, it's great fun. And Kelly Vlahos will be here because she's right about David Petraeus. And hardly anyone in the whole wide world is good on the David Petraeus issue. Why it should be that a bunch of adults get to, get buffaloed or, you know, line up to get buffaloed like, it's the 8th grade vote for vice president of the school board or whatever, some popularity contest. Because TV says that you're supposed to like this American Idol contestant. Doesn't he look snazzy in his little green pressed uniform or whatever? And then that's just supposed to work? Well, that doesn't work on me. Never did. So Kelly Vlahos, she's a little less hateful, well, quite a bit less hateful and much more substantive in her rejection of that David Petraeus myth. So I'm going to bring her on to instruct y'all a little bit about the difference between the narrative and the facts. It's always a little bit different there. All right, now obviously I'm going to go on and on and on about why Ron Paul is right and Rick Santorum is a joker and people who agree with him are stupid and things like that today. But before I even get into that, oh, and I got a ton of news, tons of news, important news, Libya war news and all different war news. But before I do that, I wanted to talk about this American exceptionalism, because part of Rick Santorum's harangue against Ron Paul last night in the Republican debate over the motivation for terrorist attacks against the United States included this reference to, I'm for American exceptionalism. And I got to complain about that, not just because on the whole I think it's just some ridiculous, stupid concept or whatever. If that was the case, I'd probably just leave it alone and not care. The problem is, I believe in American exceptionalism too. Only mine's really very different from Rick Santorum's. Rick Santorum's American exceptionalism, you know, roughly paraphrasing, is that people between Canada and Mexico, or at least, you know, the ones in power in D.C. anyway, are human beings. And they can do whatever they want to anyone else in the world because they are not human beings. And because the Americans are just such great Ubermen, because of the greatness of, I don't know, Mark Twain and James Madison and whatever, it all rubs off on us so much that we're angels and everybody else are, as Admiral Fallon said about the Iranians, ants. And we will crush them when we feel like it. We are born with impunity, the divine right of kings, perhaps. And we are so exceptional that evil becomes moral when we do it. That is what Republicans mean when they talk about American exceptionalism. But that's not what it means to me. What it means to me is the promise, basically, of what America is supposed to be, which is not the world's greatest empire. It's the modest, humble, limited commercial republic that declared independence from the world's greatest empire and disdains such enterprises. It's a land where we consider it a special place, the people, those of us who live here, because here, freedom for us is paramount. I mean, other than the timber and the rivers and whatever, there's nothing special about the land between Canada and Mexico, but what we humans make it, right? It's not magic dirt. I guess there's the miracle of that giant aquifer under the Great American Desert, but anyway, you understand. If we can succeed in the so-called American experiment of self-government, maintain our little our Republican form, keep our Bill of Rights, and have peace and prosperity, then that makes this place exceptional, especially compared to the old world, with the endless legacy of genocide and madness. Yeah, sorry about the Indians in the audience. You know, I'm not deliberately leaving you out, but you know, none of this is me saying that America's perfect. It's saying this is what America's supposed to be, right? This is the project that we're working on. A free and open society. That's what true liberals care about. Liberty. That's what true conservatives mean to conserve. True liberalism. The American way. Thomas Jefferson, not Hamilton. Hell, I'd settle for John Adams. Great is the guilt of an unnecessary war, said he, and kept us out of a war with France when everybody else was trying, well, and his party anyway, was trying to get us into one. And so it's just amazing to me, really, that what makes America great is that we believe here. This is what makes us Americans. It ain't geography. It's that we believe in the Declaration of Independence, that everybody is born with the same divine right as the king. And since he's a tyrant, he ain't got no right to put himself as authority over us. We'll create our own government with a mandate of protecting our rights, and that's it. That's the whole theory of what it means to be an American. Never mind the Constitution. It's the Declaration of Independence, those principles. Because if you accept the Declaration of Independence and those principles, then the Constitution is just temporary. It says right in there, when the government, is abusive of these rights, it is the right and the duty, in fact, of the people to alter or abolish it. That principle comes before the Constitution. And yet, if we really believe that everybody is born with natural, inherent dignity and liberty, then how in the hell does that make us so special that we can deny that very premise and sit back and, in fact, cheer when our government goes around denying life and liberty to millions of people around the world? How can we sit here and call ourselves exceptional when our society, by and large, confirms and ratifies the behavior of our government? As Martin Luther King called it then, and it's still true today, the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. And of course, it's all in the name, on one hand, of we love Afghans so much we want to give them a better life, but it's also okay if we kill them because they're just animals. And what is that? That's exceptionalism? It doesn't seem so exceptional to me, except maybe exceptionally selfish and cruel. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up in just a couple minutes, the heroic James Bamford. Here's a guy who was a producer for ABC News. And when the Monica Lewinsky thing broke, he said, "That's it. I've had enough of this. I'm going to go write books about things that matter. Back to book writing. I'm not going to participate in this nonsense." And he's written three books about the National Security Agency and an excellent book about how the Likudnik neoconservative fifth column inside the Republican Party took us to war in Iraq based on a bunch of deliberate lies. It's called The Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, and I suggest you take a look at it. Anyway, we'll be talking about the Shadow Factory and the illegal NSA Total Information Awareness. They actually renamed it Basketball when they moved it from the Pentagon to the NSA. Nobody knows what it's called now anymore, I don't guess. Then again, maybe like WikiLeaks, they just keep the same password. I don't know. Anyway, if you go to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/antiwarradio, you'll see that I stay up late last night because I gave myself a little mission. I thought, you know what I'll do? For all the Ron Paulians out there who want to participate in this argument, defending the point of view that he is putting forward about the cause of the September 11th attacks. Right, because in the middle of this argument, as Rick Santorum and the right-wing warmongers are attempting to ridicule him, this is a great time to escalate this argument. This is the, you know, the Giuliani thing happened 4 years ago, but at least since then, this is the first time this argument has really broken out into the mainstream. Again, you know, since then. Yeah. Sorry for I don't speak right, but still. So, the Ron Paulians out there, and for that matter, anybody with any common sense whatsoever, who understands that when you kill people's kids, it makes them mad, you know, and stuff like that, and would like to see this argument finally won, I got the arrows for your quiver. I've got the footnotes that you need. And I pretty much posted them all up on my Facebook page, facebook.com/antiwarradio. And here's two clips, little montages, and different speeches from the House floor where Ron Paul is explaining in the 1990s that if we keep up this terrible policy of bombing Iraq and blockading Iraq from Saudi Arabia, we are risking engendering terrorism against us. Who said so? The Saudi kingdom gave us a warning. Said, you're making things really hard for us with the radicals here, and you're putting yourselves in danger too. Ron Paul took note, while everybody else only cared about the Jerry Seinfeld finale and the Monica Lewinsky scandal and a bunch of nonsense. He was actually paying attention to what mattered in the world. He wasn't saying, yeah, and we'll deserve it. He was saying, in order to protect America, we need to stop angering people who are willing to kill themselves to kill some of us, huh? Especially when we don't need to be doing these things anyway. Okay? Also, I posted a link to a book excerpt of Imperial Hubris available at the website of National Public Radio, NPR.org. Book excerpt, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing, The War on Terrorism, by Michael Scheuer, where he explains, quote, these attacks are meant to advance bin Laden's clear, focused, limited, and widely popular foreign policy goals, the end of U.S. aid to Israel and the ultimate elimination of that state, the removal of U.S. and Western forces from the Arabian Peninsula, the removal of U.S. and Western military forces from Iraq, Afghanistan, and other Muslim lands, the end of U.S. support for the oppression of Muslims by Russia, China, and India, and the end of U.S. protection for repressive apostate Muslim regimes in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Egypt, Jordan, etc., and the conversion of the Muslim world's energy resources and sale at higher prices. So, that's it. It's not about converting your daughter to Islam and putting a scarf on her head. It never was. It's not about invading America and turning it into an Islamo-fascist caliphate where your son will kneel or be beheaded. It never was about that. The people who said that were liars. And the antidote is Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. And you could say, yeah, oh, well, he's the guy who failed to kill Bin Laden. But that's not true. He and his team, between 96 and 99, gave Bill Clinton and Sandy Berger and William Cohen and Madeleine Albright 10 chances. Actually, there's a Senate report that says 13. Scheuer claims 10 for himself and maybe more that he didn't know about. 10 chances to capture or kill Osama bin Laden before 2001 and was not allowed to by the Democrats, who said, well, we'll shoot a few Tomahawk missiles, but we'll warn them first that they're coming and miss. And then he got in trouble for complaining about that and was removed from the bin Laden unit in 1999 in the lead up to, you know, in the couple years lead up to the September 11th attack. Okay. And Michael Scheuer is a right winger. He's a right winger. He's a conservative, Catholic, Republican voter. I've interviewed the guy a dozen times or something since 2005, and he says America's government ought to kill America's enemies. Forget about it. Forget about it. He also says you ought to not kill anyone else. You ought to focus this. You got to end the policies that engender the terrorism and focus any violence on the people who actually got it coming. And anyway, so there's your footnote, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism. And right there in the introduction, which is available at the NPR website in a book excerpt there, he explains the six reasons on the list. And even if bin Laden never believed them, even if all bin Laden had ever wanted was to be the king of the caliphate, it doesn't matter. Because this is his recruitment shtick. This is what he and Ayman al-Zawahiri have said for 15 years about why Arabs and Muslims ought to join them in their fight against us. They don't cite mini skirts and junior college and whatever, freedom for women, as Rudy Giuliani put it, or exceptionalism, whatever the hell that meant when Rick Santorum said it. They hate us because we put military bases in Saudi Arabia in order to bomb and blockade Iraq. And that's the land of Mecca and Medina where Muhammad is from. Their holy Arabian Peninsula. And it pissed them off. Okay, also got a great quote from James Bamford we're going to be talking about in a minute from A Pretext for War about what they wanted to do was provoke the Americans to strike back and personally wage the battle against Muslims. Since we had already been at war against them. It was that battle that they wanted to reproduce with the 9/11 attacks. They wanted to draw the Americans into a desert Vietnam with bin Laden in the role of Ho Chi Minh. Then there's the bin Laden 2004 speech. Let me tell you what this is all about, he said. Bleeding you to bankruptcy and you're falling for it. I suggest you read the whole thing. It wouldn't take very long. Then there's Paul Wolfowitz saying, now we can get our troops out of Saudi Arabia, which was bin Laden's cause celeb from a Vanity Fair interview. And then there's the declassified judgments of the National Intelligence Council's National Intelligence Estimate from 2006, which said, we assess that the Iraqi jihad is shaping a new generation of terrorist leaders and operatives. Perceived jihadist successes there would inspire more fighters to continue the struggle elsewhere. The Iraq conflict has become the cause celeb for jihadists, breeding a deep resentment of U.S. involvement in the Muslim world and cultivating supporters for the global jihadist movement. And of course, like I always like to point out and rub in the FBI's face, whenever they hire an informant to entrap some idiot into some bogus terrorism plot, as has happened dozens of times since 2001 in this country, never ever do the informant say to the entrapped, don't you hate freedom? Don't you hate what's good about America? Don't you want to blow it up? They always say, look what America's doing in Iraq and Afghanistan. Look at what's happening in Palestine. You owe it to these people to defend them. That's what the FBI entrappers say to the entrappees. So that's it. Ron Paul is right. Michael Scheuer is right. I'm right. And anyone who says otherwise is either a damned liar or a damned fool. That's it. I win. Right? All right, good. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our first guest on the show today is James Bamford, former ABC News producer, author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and The Shadow Factory, all about the National Security Agency, America's high-tech snoops. He also wrote A Pretext for War, 9/11, Iraq, and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, and a bunch of great articles for Rolling Stone and a lot of other places. For example, The Man Who Sold the War, a profile of John Rendon from the Rendon Group, who worked with the Iraqi National Congress to sell us the lies that led to war, and on like that. Always top of the line, five-star journalism. Welcome back to the show, Jim. It's been too long.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Scott.
I really appreciate you joining us today, and I want to make sure everybody knows that at Politico.com, they can find this article, post 9/11, NSA, quote, enemies include us. And I want to talk about that, but I want to hold off for a minute, because it's a really important big deal in the news today, the big fight between Ron Paul and Rick Santorum. Again, they got into it last night over the reason for the September 11th attack. And this is something that you explain in great detail, and I think your conclusions are quite contrary to Rick Santorum's George Bushian mythology about what happened on September 11th there. And you cover this in your book, A Pretext for War, 9/11 Iraq and the Abuse of America's Intelligence Agencies, in depth. And I was just wondering if I could get you to explain, your way, what was the purpose of Bin Laden and Zawahiri wanting to do an attack like that against Americans? Was it just simply to kill as many people as possible because they hate us because we're free and they're Islamic, or what?
No, it was very clear. I've written several books that go into that topic. It's very clear if you look into his background that he was seeking, there's several ideas as to what the outcome he thought might be. But in terms of the reason, there's not much debate. It's because the U.S. Has this relationship with Israel that oppresses the Palestinians. That was always number one. His number one goal in getting back to the United States for that. And then the other reasons are the U.S. involvement in Saudi Arabia, putting U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, and also the U.S. support of the dictators in the Middle East, the king of Saudi Arabia, and on and on. So you have those as the key reasons, and those are the key reasons that the terrorists largely decided to do this suicide attack. Mohammed Atta, for example, he swore his allegiance to Osama bin Laden, decided to become a terrorist the day that Israel invaded Lebanon. And the same day he went into a mosque in Frankfurt, and or in Hamburg, rather, and decided to write his last will and testament because of that. So there's really no question that the reasons behind Osama bin Laden's attacks on the United States had their roots in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry, Jim. I have my mic off. Asking a great question that you couldn't hear. Okay, I think it's confusing to the Tea Party audience at the debate last night. It certainly was anyway. That on one hand, Ron Paul, the way he put it was, they are trying to get us out of the Middle East. They hate us for being in the Middle East. And then he says they're trying to draw us further into the Middle East. Is that contradictory? What does that mean?
Well, I'm in London, so I didn't see any of the debate last night. But I can't say what he meant by it. But from my own viewpoint, the reason that
I've seen your book on the shelf behind Ron Paul, when he's doing these interviews from his home office down in South Texas. I'm pretty sure he's learned this part of the story from you, Jim.
Well, I think what he's talking about is that the overall goal of Osama bin Laden wasn't just to blow up a few buildings in New York and Washington and let that be the end of it. He had a long-term strategy in mind, and I think that strategy included drawing the United States into a quagmire in the Middle East. I mean, you can see by history, the worst defeat the United States had prior to the 9/11, the wars post 9/11, was the Vietnam War. And I think that's what he had in mind, was to humiliate the United States, teach the United States a lesson, saying, don't come into the Middle East anymore. Lick your wounds and go back and stay in the United States. That's basically what happened after Vietnam. We left Vietnam and never went back. So I think, you know, I can't read Osama bin Laden's mind, but I think that's a pretty good estimation of what he wanted, and if that was what he wanted, that is what happened.
Sure. Well, you know, in the October 2004 speech, he says, we basically, in a nutshell, he says, we wanted to replicate what we did against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And his son gave an interview to Rolling Stone about 1 year ago, saying that this is exactly what my father wanted, was to reproduce the war that America helped them fight back in the 1980s against the USSR, because they learned the lesson that as long as you have an AK and true belief in Allah, you can bring down the biggest empire in the world. The Soviets first, and America, you're next.
Well, I agree, and that's largely what I wrote in my books, was the you had that bin Laden generation that was the first real successful generation of Arabs who defeated, instead of being defeated as they were by the British and so forth in past historical events, this is the first time they were actually able to defeat a Western power, and not only a Western power, but a Western superpower, the Soviet Union, and kick them out of a Muslim country. So now the second generation, the generation behind Osama bin Laden, was looking to do their part. They thought that this is a good start, and we're going to continue it, and they got rid of one superpower in the Middle East, and so the idea was, now we'll get rid of the other superpower that's been oppressing us in the Middle East. So I think there is a generational aspect to this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it was in 2006, not long after the Democrats won the midterm elections and took over the Congress, and the common myth was that they were going to do something to wind down the Iraq War, something like that. And Ayman al-Zawahiri gave an interview to a Pakistani, I think, TV station, maybe it was a newspaper, saying that we don't want the war in Iraq to end yet. We want the Americans to stay until they've lost 300,000 or 400,000 people. That way, they'll be completely humiliated and bloodied and bankrupt, and then they'll really go. I mean, couldn't really put it more plain than that.
That was another... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead yourself.
Well, that was another aspect of it, was not just to humiliate the United States and force them out of the Middle East in the same way that we were basically forced out of Vietnam during the Vietnam War, at the end of the Vietnam War, but to bankrupt the United States. And that was sort of Reagan's philosophy during the Cold War, was to bankrupt the Soviet Union so that they would we would keep forcing them to build more arms, to put more money into military uses, and basically bankrupt them. At least that's sort of the post-Cold War philosophy that that people attribute to Reagan. And again, that's largely what happened with 9/11. That forced the United States into a very bad financial situation.
Yep. All right, we got to leave it there. We'll be right back with Jim Bavere right after this. Boy, I better get a better one on the recording. How about? We'll be right back with Jim Bamford right after this. How do you mispronounce Jim? That's the real question. That's what I want to know. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and on the line I got James Bamford. He's in England, so I guess that means guaranteed. The National Security Agency is recording this call. Jim's the author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and The Shadow Factory, all about the National Security Agency. Is my assumption correct there, you think, Jim?
That assumes that I'm important enough for them to listen to, so...
Well, it doesn't, though. It only assumes that there's an ocean between you and I right now. That's all, right?
That's right, yeah. They could easily be tuning me in. I remember after doing the Puzzle Palace, this is in 82, before the internet and all that. My publisher had a clipping service, a story about me or a review about my book in a newspaper someplace. They sent it to me, which I thought was really good, but they missed quite a few. And when I did a Freedom Information Act request to NSA, they had everything. I mean, they had every review I'd ever done. They had every television show I'd ever done. They had every radio program I'd ever done, all nicely transcribed there. So...
Well, and it's pretty easy to see why, because what you know about the NSA, we get to find out by reading your great books. And it's all, like, untouchable. Who else's books about the NSA compare? I guess there's one or two lately, but over 25 years, you've been writing about this. No wonder they're...
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of a passion of mine to follow the NSA over these years. And when I started writing NSA, it had... far less potential get into everybody's mind and into everybody's communications than it does today. I mean, there's almost no comparison.
Right. Well, okay, the new article is Post 9/11 NSA Enemies Include Us. It's at politico.com, and make a pretty strong case in here that they can find out really kind of everything about you, including how you think, what your interests are in a depth that is unimaginable from the era of the Puzzle Palace.
Well, exactly. At the time I wrote the Puzzle Palace in 1982, the only ways people can really communicate with each other was either on the telephone, which was all connected by wires in those days, or by the U.S. mail, which was, and both of those were difficult for NSA to get. The NSA had no access to the U.S. mail, and everybody would be shocked if any government agent ever opened up somebody's letter. And the NSA had limited amount of capability to eavesdrop on U.S. Telecommunications because they weren't hardwired into the U.S. Telecommunications network. They could only intercept satellite communications in and out of the U.S., which was somewhat limited. Today, it's the opposite. Today, they can read everybody's mail, and not only can, they do. They set up these secret rooms at the telecom switches around the country so that all the emails coming in, going out, or going through the United States what they call deep packet inspected. It's inspected by this hardware and software before it ever gets to wherever it's going. It goes into the secret room, it gets analyzed by the software, and if it contains a word or a phrase or a name or an address or whatever that the NSA is interested in, it gets a copy of it, automatically gets sent to NSA for further analysis and later storage. So, in that sense, the NSA could not only just hear what we're saying on the phone, but they could also, to a large degree, read what's going on in our minds, because it's not just the phone and the emails, which is the equivalent back in the early 80s of the telephone and the U.S. mail. They could also, not only can, they do actively follow what people read on the Internet. So if you're doing a Google search or you're looking for something on the Internet, all that is transiting the American communication systems And again, that's where NSA is hardwired into. So if you happen to be looking up, if your name's on the target list, and you know it's between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people on the target list, and you're looking at something that they think is suspicious, or you happen to log into something that they're targeting, that they're watching, then you're a target. You become a target at that point, and they start eavesdropping on whatever you're doing. There was a time in the early 80s when they had a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court that was fairly aggressive in terms of who they could eavesdrop on, but the Obama administration largely watered down the FISA court, as well as the Bush administration. So those protections aren't the level of those protections aren't there like they used to be.
Well, and it sounds like if they, with all the storage and all the software that they have for accessing all these different databases at once and everything, really, if they just found out about you yesterday and they wanted to know about you, really, once they hit enter, they just, it's basically like you've been under investigation all along, because you have this massive, you know, computer paper trail that gets assembled on one page right then and there. Even if they just started investigating you today, they have all of this stuff on you to look at.
Well, and in order to, because all that takes up space, and even though you can compress data very greatly these days, the NSA is just in the process of building this massive data storage center in Utah. It's going to be 1,000,000 square feet and cost $2 billion. And it's 1,000,000 square feet, so you could, if you, you know, think how much you could put on a little thumb drive, maybe 5 gigabytes or whatever, something like that. You can imagine how much information you could put in that NSA, this highly secret NSA storage facility. Could be up to, a yottabyte of data, which is translates to somewhere around a septillion pages of text. So the idea is that the NSA really wants to capture as much information as possible and keep it there. So if today, you're not much of a threat, tomorrow they might see that you're accessing pages that they find suspicious, and then they've already got a lot of your communications already stored. So it's a very worrisome thing, but the Congress pays no attention to it. They give NSA basically whatever they want. And President Obama, at one point in the campaign, was making or expressing his fears about this type of activity and saying he would actually veto immunity to the telecom companies for taking part in this. Completely changed his viewpoint once he became elected.
Yeah, well, actually, even in the Senate, he had promised to filibuster it, and he didn't, and said, "Well, I'm going to go after the government officials, though, but I'm going to give immunity to the private people that bowed to the government's wishes on this." Then he became the president and didn't do anything about it either.
Well, he's not only not done any of that once he became president, he's greatly expanded it. This data center is being built under his presidency. He's greatly expanded what Bush started. So, he made all these great pronouncements about how he was a liberal and was angered by the infringements on U.S. Liberties by the NSA and by the Bush administration. And then, when push comes to shove, when the vote comes up in the Senate, he completely reverses himself and votes in favor of both the legislation that expanded NSA's powers, as well as the immunity to the telecom.
All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time on the show today. I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk about it, but I can suggest y'all go back and listen to previous interviews of James Bamford that I've done over the years, where we've covered this stuff in a little bit more depth. And please, why not read? There's no good reason why not to read The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, The Shadow Factory, and A Pretext for War is also great, but those first three about the National Security Agency And also check out on Nova. They did a great special called The Spy Factory, where they did the, you know, like Nova on PBS. It's the science of how the NSA has basically, as just described, taken up the project of this total information awareness on all of us. And it's absolutely groundbreaking journalism. Can't be beat. James Bamford, thank you so much for your time, Jim.
My pleasure, Scott.
All right, y'all, once more. Post-9/11, NSA, quote, enemies include us, by James Bamford. It's at politico.com right now. We'll be right back. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. Thanks for listening. Coming up here in a little while, Phil Giraldi will be here. I will ask him questions, and then he will say things. I'm certain it will be interesting. All right. Is that a good enough teaser for stay tuned to the show and don't go listen to something else instead? All right, good. Now, man, listen to this. Taliban attack across Kabul. Targets U.S. embassy. Is this not the discussion with Jason Ditz from yesterday? Reuters. Taliban suicide fighters launched a multi-pronged attack in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, firing rockets toward the U.S. and other embassies and sending three suicide bombers to targets in the city's west and near the airport. At least two civilians and two policemen were killed and 22 people were wounded in the attacks, as more than a dozen explosions echoed through the upmarket and heavily guarded diplomatic district, and NATO and Afghan helicopters roared overhead. The Taliban have launched high-profile attacks on multiple targets in Kabul in the past, but this is the first time they have organized simultaneous assaults on such separate areas. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attacks, which NATO said were an attempt to derail plans to hand over security to Afghan forces. Yeah, I would say that the NATO said something honest there. That's what it pretty much sounds like to me. Near the heavily fortified diplomatic district, insurgents took over a multi-story building under construction, fired rockets and automatic rifles at several embassy and NATO compounds. The gun battle continued into the early evening with two attackers killed and two or three more still at large, the Ministry of the Interior said on Twitter, adding that one policeman was killed. In western Kabul, just a few kilometers away, a suicide bomber detonated explosives at the entrance to a building belonging to the city's Civic Order Police, killing a policeman and wounding two. A second suicide bomber killed a civilian at the regional police center near the Habibia High School and wounded four, a senior police spokesman said. At a road near the airport, a suicide bomber was killed by police and 7 kilograms of explosives were seized, they said. And a little bit of redundancy about the Taliban claim responsibility and et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, this isn't exactly the Tet Offensive, which had a hell of a lot more casualties than this. But it still goes to show, just like, you know, go back and find an archive of me ranting and raving about something in 2005 or 6 or even 7. And it a lot of times went something like, they still haven't taken control of the capital city of the country they invaded 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 5 years ago? How in the hell is there still a Battle of Baghdad 5 years after the war ended? Well, here we are 10 years after the successful pro-democracy, pro-women, pro-kite-flying regime change in Kabul. And somehow, the Taliban is more able to attack Kabul than they ever have been before. Could it be that something is going wrong with the plan of the man? And, you know, what's infuriating about this thing is that even if you buy that we absolutely had to have a war in Afghanistan, which the Taliban, it's in the Al Jazeera again this week, there's a lot of reports like this. Do a little bit of research and you'll find plenty of Gareth Porter and lots of other great sources, including Anand Gopal, including Salim Shahzad, who was just murdered by the ISI not long ago, about how the Taliban tried to give up Osama after 9/11, but the Republicans wanted a war. And, you know, Donald Rumsfeld's whole thing was the transformation of the military. He was going to go in there and grab all those generals by the shirt collars, and he was going to hurry their asses up and make them get to work on transforming the way the military operates. We're not fighting the Soviet Union. We're fighting helpless brown civilians in their own countries. And we need to adapt our warfare strategy to those kinds of circumstances. And what he did worked. I mean, really, it was George Tenet and the CIA preempted him. And they were in Afghanistan first. And they just pointed their laser pointers at the Afghan and Taliban forces, and the U.S. Air Force dropped daisy cutters on all their heads. As one CIA guy told Robert Dreyfus at the time, if you wanted to find Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in November of 2001, bring Q-tips. So you can maybe, you know, get a little sample of the paste of their remains off the rocks. There were only a couple of few dozen that escaped at the time. And then it's too bad they were going to Iraq, but leave that out for the moment. You know, basically, Rumsfeld didn't go in much stronger than that. Rumsfeld wanted to keep it all. In fact, of course, we know they kept the Marines 20 miles away as Bin Laden escaped from Tora Bora. The Marines were right there. They could have marched and caught up and blasted the hell out of the Al-Qaeda that was left when Osama escaped from Tora Bora. But then they went and did a light and fast regime change. They put in Zalmay Khalilzad's friend, Hamid Karzai, as the very temporary dictator just until the election, you know, 10 years ago. And then they were gone. They were off to Iraq. There was no more war to fight. It was done. And now, year after year after year, for 10 years, they've escalated the war in Afghanistan to the point where here we are, a decade out from the beginning of this thing, and the Taliban has waged to date their most sophisticated suicide, you know, joint suicide bombing attack in Kabul, the capital there. I don't know if anybody's given us good numbers lately, but I sure haven't seen anything that would make me believe that they had changed their record of only controlling, you know, somewhere between 20 and 50% of the country at any given time. That is NATO, the puppet, sock puppet, pathetic government of Hamid, drug addict Karzai. And I don't mean like, you know, good drugs. I mean bad ones. At least that's according to the former U.S. ambassador there. But anyway, so light and fast did the trick back then. And I guess, you know, doing the regime change in Kabul and installing Hamid Karzai there, maybe that was a project doomed to fail no matter what. But we've obviously made the situation much more difficult for him, not better. He'd have had a better chance of surviving on his own, and that government would have had a much better chance of surviving if we just left back then. And now matters are worse. At some point, America has to leave, because guess what? You just can't conquer all of Eurasia, guys, before your dollar is worthless. And that's it, okay? Those are just the facts of the universe. So at some point, America is going to leave. And this government that we've propped up, that now has an annual budget that is 99% American money, because there is no gross domestic product in Afghanistan to speak of after two generations in a row of constant warfare. This government's going to fall, Kabul's going to fall, and it's going to fall hard like Saigon. This might not have been the Tet Offensive, but it's a mini one, and it is a portent of what's to come. You know, if we could get smart, we would get our soldiers and get our diplomats, so-called, and everybody else out of that country before it ends up one of these fleeing from the roof of Saigon with the last of the Quisling refugees hanging onto the skids, like 1975. Or was that late 74? I don't know. I forget. I wasn't quite a baby yet. But yeah, man, I don't know. You blew it. You blew it. Capiche? You ever see that Tim and Eric's awesome show? Great job. I shouldn't try to imitate them. They are funny, though. But yeah, so there you go. The Graveyard of Empires. Who would have thunk it? You can't really fight on terrain that's shaped like Colorado against a bunch of guys who are the sons and grandsons and great-grandsons of marksmen who have actually, you know, pretty sophisticated or not fancy sophisticated but good enough World War I era high powered rifles and the high ground. all your little droid attacks in the world can't win a war against people firing down from the top of a mountain at you. Ask Eric Margolis, man. He'll tell you. Should be talking with him right now or something. All right, hang on a minute. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and thanks very much for listening. It's a big deal to me that you do. Thanks. All right, now hear this.
If you are black, I think we are at the edge of an enormous crisis in national security. I think that we are greatly underestimating the threat to this country. And I think the day after we celebrated the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we should be reminded exactly what is at stake if a foreign terrorist gets a nuclear weapon into this country. We have failed for a decade to deal with North Korea. We have failed for a decade to deal with Iran. The developments in Egypt and Turkey are much more dangerous than anybody is looking at in this country. And I think we need, frankly, to ask for a very serious national dialogue. I'd like to see both the House and Senate right now holding hearings on three levels of security. What do you do in Mexico, where there's a civil war underway next door to us?
Forward,
what
do you? God's sake, shut
China.
Up.
All three of those are.
I'm sorry.
There's a lot of room to cut on the military. We are still in danger.
Answer.
All the militarism that we are involved in, and we're waiting.
I'm the worst. All right, look, I'm the worst radio show host in the world. All right, I'm trying.
Crucial if we're going to be competitive with China. All three of those China are a major threat to us.
Congressman Paul.
And Paul,
first thing I would like to do is make sure that you understand there's a difference between military spending and defense spending. I'm tired of all the militarism that we are involved in, and we're wasting this money and getting us involved. And I agree, we are still in danger, but most of the danger comes by our lack of wisdom on how we run our foreign policy. So I would say there's a lot of room to cut on the military, but not on the defense. You can slash the military spending. We don't need to be building airplanes that were used in World War II. We're always fighting the last war. But we're under great threat because we occupy so many countries. We're in 130 countries. We have 900 bases around the world. We're going broke. The purpose of Al-Qaeda was to attack us, invite us over there where they can target us. And they have been doing it. They have more attacks against us and the American interest per month than occurred in all the years before 9/11. But we're there occupying their land. And if we think that we can do that and not have retaliation, we're kidding ourselves. We have to be honest with ourselves. What would we do if another country, say China, did to us what we do to all those countries over there? So I would say a policy, a foreign policy that takes care of our national defense, that we're willing to get along with people and trade with people as the founders advised. There's no authority in the Constitution to be the policeman of the world and no nation building. Just remember, George Bush won the presidency on that platform in the year 2000, and I still think it's a good platform.
All right, let me let Senator Santorum respond, because I know you strongly disagree.
On your website on 9/11, you had a blog post that said, that basically blamed the United States for 9/11. On your website yesterday, you said that it was our actions that brought about the actions of 9/11. Now, Congressman Paul, that is irresponsible. A president of the United States running for someone who's running for the president of the United States in the Republican Party should not be parroting what Osama bin Laden said on 9/11. We are not being attacked, and we were not attacked because of our actions. We were attacked, as Newt talked about, because we have a civilization that is antithetical to the civilization of the jihadists. And they want to kill us because of who we are and what we stand for. And we stand for American exceptionalism. We stand for freedom and opportunity for everybody around the world. And I am not ashamed to do that.
30 seconds, Mr. Paul.
As long as this country follows that idea, we're going to be under a lot of danger. This whole idea that the whole Muslim world is responsible for this and they're attacking us because we're free and prosperous, that is just not true. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been explicit
They have been explicit, and they wrote and said that we attacked America because you had bases on our Holy Land in Saudi Arabia, you do not give Palestinians a fair treatment, and you have been bombing. I didn't say that. I'm trying to get you to understand what the motive was behind the bombing. At the same time, we had been bombing and killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis for 10 years. Would you be annoyed? If you're not annoyed,
thank you, Congressman,
then there's some problem.
All right, we're going to stay on this subject. We have a question from the audience. Go ahead.
All right, well, that thing started too early and ended too early, that clip. Poorly chosen by me, sorry. But anyway, so that's Ron Paul up there saying, sorry if you don't like it, the truth is the truth. In fact, his article at antiwar.com today, at the bottom of the article, this is what Ron Paul says here at the end of the article. He says, sometimes it can be very uncomfortable to ask the right questions and face the truth. When a slick politician comes along and gives a much more soothing, self-congratulating version of events, it is very tempting to simply believe what we would like to hear. But listening to lies does not make us safer, even though it might make us feel better about ourselves. And you notice, right, that Rick Santorum has no facts, only assertions. America must have a war of civilizations with all billion-plus Muslims in the world? Really? That's like Mein Kampf madness right there is what that is. From Rick Santorum. Fact-free, bloodlust beyond measure. Ignorance and arrogance of the very worst combination. And Ron Paul says, you know what? I'm sorry, but it was a strategy and a war, and it was about real things that happen on this real earth, not some religious obsession. It was about politics. It was about American bases in Saudi Arabia used to blockade and bomb Iraq. Even if you don't like it, it's just true. And as he mentioned as well, the perpetual Israeli war against the people of Palestine. It's on the PBS NewsHour website. The Declaration of War Against the Americans Occupying the Land of the Two Holy Places is the title. Bin Laden's Declaration of War in 1996, and they have the 1998 version there as well. And they don't say, we'll teach you to send your daughters to the university. It doesn't say that. It says, you kill our women and children. Let's do this then. If you're going to use Hosni Mubarak to torture our people to death, you're going to pay the Israelis and arm the Israelis to bomb our people to death. If you're going to occupy our holy land to strangle the Iraqi people to death, as Ron Paul correctly said right there, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, they said, well, then we're going to bring you here and have a real war with you. What the Middle East didn't have yet was widespread ground troops everywhere, only in invited countries, right? Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. They didn't have an occupation. They didn't have a war to fight in the Middle East. And that's what Al-Qaeda wanted, was for us to bring a war there. It's just as simple as that. It's only true. It doesn't matter if it hurts your feelings or not. It's just true. It doesn't mean that it's justified for Osama bin Laden to act like a Republican or a Democrat and go around murdering civilians. It just means this is why he murders civilians. That's all. And it's how he gets people to join his cause. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and our next guest is Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA counterterrorism officer, and contributing editor to the American Conservative Magazine, and regular contributor, of course, to antiwar.com. Welcome back to the show, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. How about you?
I'm doing great. Oh, also, I don't know how I forgot to say this, but he's the executive director, Phil Giraldi is, of the Council for the National Interest Foundation. And I think that if you were to go to their website and read the substance, you would be impressed and informed. So that's, I believe, cnifonline.org. Is that right, Phil?
cnionline.org.
CNIonline. Yeah, I don't know where I got F from. I don't know what the hell's going on. Anyway, hey, so thanks for joining us today. I was wondering, first of all, if you could comment on the recent scandal brewing about the CIA keeping information about Hamzi and Al-Midhar, the Al-Qaeda hijackers that landed in Southern California, from the FBI until the very last minute, and apparently from Richard Clark. And there was a documentary that was, or at least part of one, that was supposed to be released on September 11th, and the CIA is threatening them with legal action because they say they're going to reveal, they've already revealed a guy named Richard Blee, who was the head of the Bin Laden unit for a time there anyway, and his two or three subordinates who supposedly obstructed the FBI from learning about these 9/11 hijackers. Phil, your take.
Well, I mean, this story in its general outlines has been out there for quite a while. I mean, it was actually, even the 9/11 Commission came up with information indicating clearly that the CIA was being obstructionist in terms of providing information across the board in terms of the intelligence and law enforcement communities. And so it's not really a surprise to hear about this. It's kind of a surprise to see names that I'm familiar with, like Dick Blee and everything, showing up. And the fact that very specific information on specific hijackers is now surfacing. That's the interesting aspect of it. But I think we've kind of known in a broad brush way for a while that this was going on.
Yeah. It sure seems like after 10 years of counting them up, there's a lot of warnings and a lot of information ignored. You can see why people think, at the very least, that there had to have been a deliberate blind eye turn to all this information, that this obstruction was for a reason. We're going to take one on the chin. That way we can go ahead and get this terror war started off on the right foot from the point of view of the people in power. Is that crazy?
Well, it's not crazy, but it's not the whole picture either. I think that it's the same kind of argument that was made that that Franklin Roosevelt let Pearl Harbor happen to start the war. You know, I think people who've been in the government, as I've been in the government, and most other people who have had the same experience, I think would argue that this is certainly possibly true. But the fact is that government is essentially inefficient in the way it operates, and because of that, these kinds of glitches are more normal than one might think. And I think that actually is another story that people should be talking about, that government is so inefficient that you really don't want to be giving them all these resources for them basically to piss away and not make you any safer. I was reading the accounts this weekend of the two airliners that were followed by jets because there were five individuals who were spending too much time in the lavatories. I mean, this it would be comic opera, except that it's dead serious. These people were hauled off the plane, put in handcuffs, and interrogated. So it's just, these stories become more and more absurd.
Yeah. Well, you know, I went to New York City over the weekend to give a little talk about the causes of September 11th, the way I see it. And on the way home on September 11th, at JFK Airport, I was the only one to refuse the naked body scanner and get the pat-down, which is just as bad, really, instead. But I just sat there, and they made me stand there and time out for 5 minutes and watch everybody else go through. And everybody's just staring at their socks, putting their daughters through the naked porno scanner, Phil, like it's no big deal, like we're all a bunch of East Germans or something.
Well, maybe we have become East Germans.
It's ill. Well, you know, you were at the CIA. Remind me about how your career went there, because I think you were kind of retired and then went back as a contractor after 9/11, some kind of thing.
Yeah, I was in for 16 straight years as an operations officer overseas, and I was in Europe and the Middle East. And then I left and came back in 2001 and was at CIA headquarters when 9/11 occurred. So I was back for about a year and then left it again.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can, I don't know, whatever. I'll go ahead and ask you. You've always been a straight shooter with me, and you can always say I have no answer if you have no answer. But I wonder about, you know, the chatter, as the CIA calls it, at the CIA after September 11th, about everybody knows we had 10 million chances to stop this thing.
Well, most of the chatter at that point was just kind of sheer panic. The day when 9/11 happened, the building emptied out so fast into the parking lot, it was unbelievable. And then the anniversary of 9/11, the following year, the building also emptied out into the parking lot. Our brave desk-bound warriors showing their mettle, I think. There was a lot of confusion at CIA. People, even within the agency, people don't share information very much. And there were people like myself, when, as this process started to play out after 9/11, who began to get concerned because suddenly the focus shifted to Iraq. And nobody could quite understand what was going on, for good reason, I would say. But, you know, it's the 9/11 business, some people were in the loop. There were a lot of people, I remember, at headquarters who were saying in August, July and August, before 9/11, that something was coming. And they were, like, in a panic mode about it. But they didn't know exactly what.
Yeah. Although, yeah, apparently some of them did know. Like, here are some guys we followed from the Malaysia meeting to Southern California.
So yeah, that's right.
Real Al-Qaeda dudes in the country that they can connect directly to, you know, the Yemen switchboard house and whatever. It was the son-in-law of the guy that owned the Yemen switchboard house, Phil.
Sure. Some of them did know.
And
but
they
were
both wanted in the coal bombing by the FBI and the grand jury.
Yep, some of them did know, but, you know, it might have been a circle of about five people who decided they were going to keep it secret because they were going to develop this information into something much bigger. That, you know, I'm sure that's the way they were thinking.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't doubt it either. I mean, people say, you know, the fighter jets should have gone immediately up and saved the day in every way, and I'm going, look, the fighter jets are patrolling the DMZ over there at the 38th parallel. When have they ever defended D.C. from an aerial attack? Never.
Yeah. Well, and you can imagine the reaction if they'd shot down a civilian airliner.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, how would you know what the target is until it hits it?
Yeah, well, so apparently, according to Andrew Coburn, Dick Cheney ordered 11 planes shot down, and the Air Force basically just said no. Mm-hmm. You know, we're just not going to pass that order down. We won't do it. These are the 11 planes that failed to immediately say everything's okay.
Well, they should have probably found out where Dick Cheney was and done something with him. But anyway, the whole thing is absurd because, you know, you have a fighter jet. It's flying near a civilian aircraft, and the civilian aircraft, you don't know what the target is until it actually kind of veers off and hits it. And so what are you going to do? You're going to shoot the airliner all out of the skies over Virginia or something like that just because it might be going somewhere to hit something?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, if they really had narrowed down which planes had, you know, said, we have a bomb on board or whatever, and they were nearby enough and knew that this was definitely a hijack and not one of the maybes, I guess I could maybe see it, you know, to save the Capitol building and the Congress from being obliterated.
Well, let's not go too far with that argument about obliterating Congress. I mean, Scott, come on.
Well, I want rid of them. I want a natural disaster to sink the Capitol into the sea or something, but I don't want it to just leave the White House and Dick Cheney and George Bush with no more checks and balances in the world either, you know?
Yeah, I guess you've got a point there.
Although
yeah,
Tom
I know,
Daschle
but again,
never was much of a check and balance, was he?
No, not really. No, but I mean, the problem with that argument is that you don't actually know until they actually hit the Twin Towers, nobody actually knew that the planes were going to be used as weapons. So here you're shooting down civilian airliners for something that might be happening, but you don't know.
All right. Well, hold it right there. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about all kinds of other things, too. It's Phil Giraldi from Antiwar.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. It's Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Phil Giraldi, former CIA and DIA officer. And contributing editor at the American Conservative Magazine, writer at antiwar.com, and executive director of the Council for the National Interest. And I got at least three different subjects I want to cover with you real quick here, Phil. First of all, I'm wondering if you're enjoying possibly being the subject of an FBI counterintelligence investigation to see whether you're an agent of a foreign power due to your affiliation with antiwar.com.
Well, I think I've been on that receiving end a few times already, so I'm not too disturbed by it. And getting back to our subject of competence of government, I assume the investigation will be so incompetent that they won't be able to find me.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, to read through the redactions of the FBI PDF file there is to betray the ignorance of the author in such a bad way. You know, people say that they can go back through the Bible and compare different books supposedly written by John to see if it was really the same author by literary comparison or whatever. Well, I'm not that sophisticated at that technique. However, in reading that document, I thought, this guy could be teaching gym to fifth graders. It's ridiculous.
Well, that's what it's all about. I mean, you know, you give our investigative agencies a lot of money They have a lot of time on their hands. They hire a lot of people, and that's the result.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right, well, okay, so next subject I want to ask you about, I guess, is the coming very soon, I don't know the day on it, that they're supposed to have this vote in the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York, whether Palestine can be recognized as a state under international law. The U.S. has promised to veto it, and it seems to be coming to a real head over in the Middle East, as the Saudis are announcing, as it says on the front page of antiwar.com today, that their alliance with us is broken if we veto this thing. I don't know whether you think that's credible or not. Maybe you can comment on that. And also, tensions between the former allies, Turkey and Israel, seem to be at an all-time high for a long time anyway. So please fill us in. What the hell's going on in the world over there, man?
Yeah, well, what's going to happen is in a week's time, the 22nd is the date I've seen, the Palestinians are going to apply for full membership in the United Nations. They already have basically what they consider statehood in certain other capacities, and they have observer status in the UN. But the fact is they're not recognized as a full member state in the United Nations. Israel is of course very opposed to it because there are a number of issues. I mean, the Palestinian statehood would mean statehood within the 1967 borders. So that would be a big problem for Israel with its settlements policy. It would also have come for a vote, and the vote...
Nope. Phil, did I lose you? Aw, man. God dang, was it a Comrex or whatever hanging up on my phone call? That ain't fair. All right, well, you know what happens in a situation like this. I play Rothbard. That's what happens. Sometimes I get lucky and cue it up right to the part where he's quoting Garrett Gray.
These criteria to apply fully to the United States. Having discovered that the United States had developed all the hallmarks of empire, Garrett added that the United States, like previous empires, feels itself to be a prisoner of history. For beyond fear lies collective security, and the playing of the supposedly destined American role upon the world stage. Garrett concluded, "It is our turn." Our turn to do what? Our turn to assume the responsibilities of moral leadership in the world. Our turn to maintain a balance of power against the forces of evil everywhere, in Europe and Asia and Africa, in the Atlantic and in the Pacific, by air and by sea. Evil, in this case, being the Russian barbarian. Our turn.
All right, y'all,
to
welcome
keep
back.
The peace of the world.
Looks like one of those Israeli companies that runs the American telecommunications system, featured so heavily in James Bamford's book, The Shadow Factory, didn't like what Phil was saying about the vote on the Palestinian state coming up in the General Assembly and the consequences in the region. Phil?
Yeah, well, I was basically saying there, you know, there is actually a lot of downside for Israel if the Palestinians were to get full membership in the UN. They would have access to the International Criminal Court, for example, where they can try Israeli officials and military officers as war criminals. They would be able to use UNESCO as a tool to keep the Israelis from knocking down Arab neighborhoods in Jerusalem and elsewhere. They would also be defining their state by the 1967 borders, which would create tremendous problems for Israel. So Israel doesn't want this. The United States is, of course, on board and will use its veto. But then, you know, the payoff is going to be that the United States is going to pay the piper on this, because essentially we're going to be blamed for enabling this, which is, of course, correct. We will become even more so than now targets of terrorism. There'll be a lot of genuine rage on the Arab street about this. Countries like Egypt and Turkey are not going to take it well, nor Pakistan. So there's a lot of downside for the U.S.
What about that threat from the Saudis that they're going to break off their alliance with us? Do you think that's plausible?
I've seen that voiced a couple times. It was first came up a couple weeks ago in an editorial written by Al Turki, who was the ambassador of the U.S., saying essentially that this would break. Essentially, break the relationship because it just goes too far, so I would take it seriously.
Well, it's not that I have any love for the Saudi kingdom or anything like that. It's just the instability of the whole thing. If there's going to be, 500 different unforeseen consequences breaking out all over, that's the problem.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting? There was an article in the New York Times on Sunday discussing the whole issue of Israel vis-a-vis Egypt, Turkey, and the Palestinians. And it basically, it conceded. It said, we forget that essentially there is incredible levels of rage among Muslim and Arab communities about Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, and that's what's driving all this process, and we forget about that, and we try to ignore the fact that it is there's a real reason why this thing goes on the way it does so it was kind of interesting to see that in the New York Times, which has been in denial for a long time now.
Right. Well, and as James Bamford explained earlier on the show, that Mohammed Atta and Osama bin Laden both cited the Israeli war in Lebanon in 1996 as the, that's it. You cross the line and it's on now, demarcation in this thing.
Yeah, I mean, we tend to think this is all kind of politics playing out, but people actually get angry about some of this stuff with good reason. And, we're seeing that happen now. And the Egyptian army actually is, of course, serving as a restraint on the people, because the people would like to see even stronger action against Israel. But again, Israel plays it so stupid. I mean, all they had to do was apologize for killing those five Egyptian policemen at the border, explain it was an accident, and apologize. All they had to do with the Turks was apologize for the nine Turks that they killed, but they won't do it. And it boggles the mind to think how idiotic these people are in terms of the posturing that they go through.
Mm-hmm. Well, which brings us back to Turkey here, because ever since the Mavi Marmara attack, back in, a year and a few months ago, the relationship between the Turks and the Israelis seems to have been really falling apart. And lately, I don't know too much about it, honestly, but I saw at least news articles saying that the Turks were going to use their navy next time to protect the next Gaza blockade breaking flotilla of humanitarian aid, something like that. And I was thinking, are these former friends really that far apart now that they're actually screwing around with situations that could lead to war?
No, I don't think so. I think if you examine the Turkish statement carefully, what the Turks said was that they would use the Turkish Navy to protect Turkish vessels going to break the blockade of Gaza. Now, the fact is there are no Turkish vessels currently planned to be going to break the blockade of Gaza. So it was more or less a shot across the bows of the Israelis saying, look, we're serious about this, and it could come to something like this. But there's no intention to push it that far, at least on the Turkish side. But, you have Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister of Israel, saying that he's thinking about doing something with terrorist groups that are attacking Turkey, which would be the Kurds. So, I mean, this stuff gets insane.
Yeah, well, the Turkish military and spy services have been best buddies with the Israelis for a generation or something, at least, right?
Yeah, at least. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Well, and they're still friends, or those relationships have been broken as well in the last year, you think?
I think a lot of those generals are now gone.
Hmm. All right. We're out of time. Thanks very much for yours, Phil.
Okay, Scott, take care.
Phil Giraldi, everybody. Antiwar.com/Giraldi. And the Council for the National Interest, CNI.org, CNIonline.org, and the American Conservative Magazine. Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome back. It's Anti-War Radio. And, you heard James Bamford earlier. You heard Michael Scheuer last week. You just heard Phil Giraldi explain the reason we were attacked on September 11th was because of Israel. And also because of the blockade against Iraq enforced from bases in Saudi Arabia. And support for Hosni Mubarak, the tortured dictator of Egypt, etc. And since, finally, again, this argument has been brought to the forefront by the heroic Dr. Paul in the Republican primary presidential debate again last night, and the debate before last as well. And because the Pew poll came out just last week, as Glenn Greenwald highlighted on this show, that asked, is it possible that American wrongdoing in the Middle East helped lead to the motivation for the September 11th attackers? And 43% said yes. Reality is finally seeping through. We don't have to kill all billion Muslims. It wasn't them, and it wasn't Islam. And here, for more of that, is again Michael Scheuer, this time from C-SPAN. Someone posted this on my Facebook page, facebook.com/antiwarradio. I've shared it and reshared it a couple of times, and I highly suggest you take a look at it yourself and maybe pass it around. Here, I know he and Philip Giraldi have their differences of opinion, but both of them are former CIA officers. Both of them are conservatives. Both of them are straight shooters. And here they are explaining to you what the hell is going on in the world and why. Again, Michael Scheuer here from C-SPAN.
Yes, you know, this cuts to the heart of, I think, an issue that Americans really need to consider if they don't want to fight this war forever. American lifestyle, democracy, women in the workplace, elections, liberty, all of those things, the Islamists, Al-Qaeda, its allies, would never have in a country that they governed. That's very clear. But the idea that has been pushed by President Clinton and President Bush and Mr. Cheney and Barack Obama and Senator McCain, that America is being attacked because of those things, is a disservice to the population of the United States. This war is not against Americans because we're Americans. It's against it's motivated by the activities of our government and its allies in the Muslim world. Certainly, Israel is an enormous problem for the United States and an enormous motivator for the Islamists who are active around the world, including in America and Canada and Britain. But it's not only that. It's our support for the Saudi police state. It is our exploitation of what, at low prices, at least as the Islamists consider it, of Middle Eastern oil, of Muslim oil. It's our presence on the Arabian Peninsula and our military activities in Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia and other places. And none of that is to say that those policies or actions are wrong. I would vote to change several of them very drastically, but that's not the point. The point is, unless you understand the motivation of your enemy, you are never going to be able to understand his durability, his intentions, or his ability to recruit in the coming generations. And that's where we are at the moment. And certainly, you can argue about whether you should support the Israelis or not support the Israelis. That's a perfectly legitimate debate. But when you say that Israel is an enormous burden on U.S. interests, and our relationship with the Israelis is getting American soldiers killed overseas and threatening us at home, that's just a fact. You can't get away from that fact. And that's the fact that should form the basis of the conversation about whether we continue or not continue support for Israel.
All right, so there you have it. Just the facts. As Michael Scheuer has written in his books, Imperial Hubris and Marching Toward Hell. His most recent was a biography of Osama bin Laden. And you just add it up. There's just no question that we're losing this thing. And I'm not saying that Dick Cheney is just a fool. Obviously, he is a sick, evil, premeditated psychopath fool. You know, I look at my Facebook friends feed or whatever, for example. A lot of people are 9/11 truthers these days, a lot. And my position is basically that it might as well have been an inside job for the degree to which they exploited it. to expand the American empire in the Middle East. They might as well have done it. They used it as an excuse to kill a million Iraqis. You're not supposed to remember that on September 11th, when it was killing Iraqis from Saudi Arabia, about a million of them in the 1990s, that got us attacked in the first place. And killed a million more with 9/11 as the excuse. How do you like that? As though the guy with the mustache in the olive green was the same guy as the guy with the beard in the robes. Oh yeah, get them confused pretty easily. So it's not that Dick Cheney was some doe-eyed innocent who got scared, although I'm sure he was very frightened. Yes, he was a sick, evil, premeditated psychopath who took full advantage in order to institute the unipolar world doctrine. We will never allow any nation or any combination of nations to even think about arming up as powerful as us. We'll obliterate them long before that. We will never stand a near peer competitor in the world anywhere ever. And Iraq will be our Alderaan, where we prove that we really mean it. Afghanistan, too remote to make an effective demonstration, you understand. But Iraq, it was doable. And they had buildings that were at least three stories tall that we could bomb that are impressive on TV for your fireworks show, as Bill Hicks called it. So, the truthers have a point, but the real point is that Bin Laden basically saw, as his son explains in Rolling Stone magazine in a year ago's issue, he saw George Bush and Dick Cheney's inauguration as a heaven sent. He kept trying to provoke Bin Laden, Bill Clinton, Freudian thing there maybe, he kept trying to provoke Bill Clinton, couldn't get nothing but some Monica missiles. Which made a hero out of Bin Laden, but failed to kill him. As Clinton turned down 10 different chances that Scheuer, who you just heard, and his team gave him to do something about this before September 11th. But when George Bush and Dick Cheney got elected, Bin Laden saw. This is not a caveman, this is the son of a billionaire. A highly educated one in the ways of the world. And he saw these Republicans and said, these guys are so corrupt and so pretend macho that they are going to fall for my red flag trick perfect. And there he and his guys are waiting with swords to stab us in the spine, bleed us to bankruptcy, as they say in plain English, translated from the original Arabic. And this is so not a secret. It's so funny to hear Rick Santorum say, no, it's because they hate us because of how wonderful we are. Really? Because that's not what they said when they give interviews to CNN and ABC News in 1996. They were very specific. And again and again and again. It doesn't matter whether they believe their own hype or not. Bin Laden and Zawahiri could be the most cynical, lying, manipulative, self-interested people in the world. But this shtick of theirs, that people ought to join them to fight against us because of our foreign policy, works. It has worked. And these policies are wrong anyway. Blockading the Iraqi people to death. Supporting Israel in their occupation of Palestine that's now gone on longer than the Soviets occupied Eastern Europe. After World War II. It's madness. All we gotta do is just quit it. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Boy, I've been screwing up a lot today. My internet connection has been too. Good times. Well, whatever. According to Amnesty International, our heroes in Libya torture people. Mostly, apparently, for the crime of being black. How do you like that? What a great achievement of our first black president. No worse than what George W. Bush did in Iraq. 5 million refugees there. Beat that, Barack Obama. I know he's trying hard to be a worse mass killer and destroyer of civilizations than George W. Bush, but he's got a lot of ground to catch up on. George W. Bush had a big, well, he had a pretty good head start, too. He hit the ground running, that Barack Obama, bombing Pakistan within 3 days of taking office. No, within 1 day. It was George Bush that bombed Iraq within 3 days of taking office. Sorry, I get my immediate bombings of helpless people confused sometimes. But anyway, I had dead air a while back because I hit the wrong button. I had dead air just a minute ago because my internet went out. I was supposed to start an interview with Kelly Vlahos 20 minutes ago. But I forgot. Usually I start the interviews at the bottom of the hour. And I only just remembered that, oops, I was supposed to start this interview half an hour ago, and now probably I won't be able to interview her at all. Although I guess I will try to call her at the next commercial break and see if maybe. Okay, so hire me. I'm the worst broadcaster ever. The only thing is I'm right about everything. So that pretty much ameliorates the whole horrible at broadcasting problem, right? It's fair enough, man. It's all right to be absolutely horrible at broadcasting and do radio for a living, isn't it? Yeah, if you like reading about how America's allies are terrorists and torturers, just check out the front pages of antiwar.com all day, every day. In Bahrain, yeah, they're torturers and killers. They work for us. Station our 5th Fleet on their little island there in the Persian Gulf. And in Egypt, a renewed clampdown at the behest of the United States. You're letting this whole democratic revolution thing get too far out of hand, says the U.S. government to their former puppet dictatorship over there as they reassert control. They install a bunch of veterans of the Iraq and Afghan war who fought on the other side of our troops now to install them in power in Tripoli. And of course, the war against the people of Somalia rages on indefinitely. Tomorrow we'll have Chris Floyd, author of the Empire Burlesque blog, on the show to talk about what's going on in Somalia. But you know what? While I have a minute, since I screwed up and didn't start my interview with Kelly Vlahos here, I want to share with you a little bit from Blowback in Somalia, new at thenation.com by Jeremy Scahill with his journalistic partner Rick Rowley. The notorious Somali paramilitary warlord, who goes by the nom de guerre Idha Ade, or White Eyes, walks along trenches on the outskirts of Mogadishu's Bakara market, once occupied by fighters from the Shabab, the Islamic militant group that has pledged allegiance to Al-Qaeda. In one of the trenches, the foot of corpses pokes out from a makeshift grave consisting of some sand dumped loosely over the body. One of Idha Ade's militiamen says that the body is that of a foreigner who fought alongside the Shabab. "We bury their dead, and we also capture them alive," he said in a low, raspy voice. "We take care of them if they are Somali, but if we capture a foreigner, we execute them, so that others will see we have no mercy." Despite such thug talk, Idha Ade is not simply a warlord, at least not officially anymore. Nowadays, he is addressed as General Yusuf Mohammed Siad, and he wears a Somali military uniform, complete with a red beret and 3 stars on his shoulder. His weapons and his newfound legitimacy were bestowed upon him by the U.S.-sponsored African Union force known as AMISOM that currently occupies large swaths of Mogadishu. It is quite a turnabout. 5 years ago, he was one of Al-Qaeda and the Shabab's key paramilitary allies and a commander of one of the most powerful Islamic factions in Somalia fighting against foreign forces and the U.S.-backed Somali government. He openly admits to having sheltered some of the most notorious Al-Qaeda figures, including Fazul Abdullah Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, and to deceiving the CIA in order to protect the men. Fazul was killed in June in Mogadishu. That's in his other article. It was an accident. They just got lucky and murdered a bunch of guys, and it turned out it was one of the guys they were looking for. "The CIA failed to convince me to work with them. Idha Ade recalls of his meetings in Somalia, Kenya, and Dubai with agency operatives beginning in 2004, when he says he met the CIA's East Africa chief in the Emirates. They offered me money. They offered funding for the region I was controlling. They offered me influence and power in Somalia through U.S. cooperation. But I refused all those offers. At the time, Idha Ade, like many Muslims around the globe, viewed the United States as arrogant and on a crusade against Islam. Quote, personally, I thought of even Osama bin Laden himself as a good man who only wanted the implementation of Islamic law, end quote. He tells me at one of his homes in Mogadishu. If you're just tuning in, this is Jeremy Scahill, the brilliant journalist at TheNation.com. Yusuf Mohammed Siad was not always known as Idha Ade, one of the main warlords who divided and destroyed Somalia during the civil war that raged through the 1990s. He brutally took control of the lower Shabelle region, which was overwhelmingly populated by a rival clan, earning him the moniker the Butcher. There are allegations that he ran drugs and weapons trafficking operations from the Mirka port. Then, as the religious and political winds began to shift in Somalia after September 11th, he remade himself into an Islamic sheikh of sorts in the mid-2000s and vowed to fight foreign invaders, including rival warlords funded and directed by the CIA. Perhaps more than any other figure, Idha Ade embodies the mind-boggling constellation of allegiances and double crosses that has marked Somalia since its last stable government fell in 1991, and his current role encapsulates the contradictions of the country's present. He is a warlord who believes in Sharia law, is friendly with the CIA, and takes money and weapons from Amisom. There are large parts of Mogadishu that are not accessible without his permission, and he controls one of the largest militias and possesses more technicals, truck-mounted heavy automatic weapons in the city, than any other warlord. While the United States and other Western powers have spent hundreds of millions of dollars on arms, training, and equipment for the Ugandan and Burundian militaries under the auspices of AMISOM, the Somali military remains underfunded and underarmed. Its soldiers are poorly paid, highly undisciplined, and at the end of the day, more loyal to their clans than to the central government. That's where Idha Ade's rent-a-militia comes in. Man, don't you just love it when Jeremy Scahill writes things? I sure as hell do. Sorry that I don't have time to even read a fifth of this thing to you, but I'm begging you to go and look at TheNation.com and the article Blowback in Somalia. And in fact, while you're there, just search for Somalia and Scahill, and you'll find his last article about the secret CIA and JSOC torture prison dungeon beneath Mogadishu, where Barack Obama continues George Bush's torture legacy. The great Scahill at The Nation. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Well, I screwed up. I was supposed to call Kelly Vallejos half an hour ago, and I didn't. So now, I don't get to ask her questions about what a failure David Petraeus is. The biggest joke of a general, probably in all of American history. But, with a media package that can't be beat. Anyway, that'll happen on Thursday. Right now, I'm going to hit mute and sneeze. All right. Luckily, that one only came in ones instead of twos, like usual. All right. And now for someone who is good on just about everything, again.
I'm Congressman Ron Paul, a congressman from Texas. I've been in Congress for 20 years. My goal has always been to promote the cause of liberty and to obey the Constitution. I plan to do that as president as well.
Congressman Paul, let me expand this conversation. Do you agree with Governor Perry that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme?
Well, I agree that Social Security is broke. And we spent all the money, and it's on its last legs unless we do something. One bill that I had in Congress that never got passed was to prevent the Congress from spending any of that money on the wars and all the nonsense that we do around the world.
Now, the other thing that I would like to see done is a transition. I think it's terrible that the Social Security system is in the problems. It has the problems. But if people wouldn't have spent the money, we would be okay. Now, what I would like to do is to allow all the young people to get out of Social Security and go on their own. Now, the big question is how would the funding occur?
All right, hold that thought for a minute because I want Herman Cain.
Would you repeal the prescription drugs?
Paul, what about you? Would you repeal it?
Well, we shouldn't have never started it. I voted against it, but that sure wouldn't be on my high list. I would find a lot of cuts a lot of other places. Matter of fact, on Social Security, it is already being reformed because the cost of living increases aren't there, so the value is going down. So, no, there's places we should cut, and we spend, and I'm not sure I can get anybody to agree with me on here, on this panel, but we spend $1.5 trillion overseas in wars that we don't need to be in. And we need to cut there and then put this money back into our economy here. And that is the only way to achieve it. Then it still wouldn't be enough in order to get some people out. What we need to do is cut the Department of Education, the Department of Energy, and all these parts and get rid of them. Then we can do it.
We're going to get to national security. Don't worry. Congress, we're here in Tampa. Let's go right to a question from the audience. Please give us your name.
Good evening. I'm Steve Broutsong with the Tea Party of Greater Gaston County from Gastonia, North Carolina. My question tonight is, what is your position on the Federal Reserve? Should it indeed be audited and be held accountable by the American people?
Senator Santorum.
And then the hilarious part here is they let Santorum, Bachman, Cain, Romney, and Perry answer, but they didn't let Ron Paul answer the question about the Federal Reserve. Then they ask whether Perry deserves credit for creating the jobs in Texas.
Congressman Paul, you're from Texas. Does your governor deserve all that credit?
Not quite. I'm a taxpayer there. My taxes have gone up. Our taxes have doubled since he's been in office. Our spending has gone up double. Our debt has gone up nearly triple. So, no, and 170,000 of the jobs were government jobs. So I would put a little damper on this, but I don't want to offend the governor because he might raise my taxes or something. But I would like to mention something that was said earlier about a tax cut. And how do you pay for a tax cut? I think that's the wrong principle, because when you give people their money back, it's their money. You don't have to pay for it. That means the government owns all of our money if you look that way.
All right.
So we have to cut the spending. And a good way to start, there's a little embassy we built over in Baghdad. It cost us $1 billion. It's bigger than the Vatican. That's what's bankrupting this country. And that's the easy place to cut. That's where we should be cutting.
Governor Perry, Congressman Paul.
The executive orders have been grossly abused by all administrations for a lot of years. Some executive orders are legal. When the president executes proper function of the presidency, like moving troops and other things, yes, it's done with an executive order. But the executive order should never be used to legislate. That is what is so bad. So the executive order should be taken under control, and I've made a promise, if as president, I would never use the executive order to legislate.
Governor Perry, as you well know, Governor, before I get to Michelle Bachman, I want to just, you're a physician, Ron Paul, so you're a doctor. You know something about this subject. Let me ask you this hypothetical question. A healthy 30-year-old young man has a good job, makes a good living, but decides, you know what, I'm not going to spend $200 or $300 a month for health insurance because I'm healthy, I don't need it. But, you know, something terrible happens, all of a sudden he needs it. Who's going to pay for if he goes into a coma,
well,
for example? Who pays for that?
In a society that you accept welfareism and socialism, he expects the government to take care of
him. Well, what do you want?
But what he should do is whatever he wants to do and assume responsibility for himself. My advice to him would have a major medical policy, but not before.
But he doesn't have that. He doesn't have it, and he needs intensive care for 6 months. Who pays?
That's what freedom is all about, taking your own risk. This whole idea that you have to prepare and take care of everybody.
But, Congressman, are you saying the society should just let him die?
No.
Yeah!
I practiced medicine before we had Medicaid in the early 1960s when I got out of medical school. I practiced at Santa Rosa Hospital in San Antonio, and the churches took care of them. We never turned anybody away from the hospital. And we've given up on this whole concept that we might take care of ourselves, assume responsibility for ourselves, our neighbors, our friends, our churches would do it. This whole idea, that's the reason the cost is so high. The cost is so high, we cause a dump it on the government, becomes a bureaucracy, it becomes special interest, it kowtows to the insurance companies and the drug companies. Then on top of that, you have the inflation. The inflation devalues the dollar. We have lack of competition. There's no competition in medicine. Everybody's protected by licensing. We should actually legalize alternative health care, allow people to have, practice what they want.
Congressman Bachman, go ahead and weigh in on this. Congressman Paul.
First thing I would like to do is make sure that you understand there's a difference between military spending and defense spending. I'm tired of all the militarism that we are involved in, and we're wasting this money and getting us involved. And I agree, we are still in danger, but most of the danger comes by our lack of wisdom on how we run our foreign policy. So I would say there's a lot of room to cut on the military, but not on the defense. You can slash the military spending. We don't need to be building airplanes that were used in World War II. We're always fighting the last war. But we're under great threat because we occupy so many countries. We're in 130 countries. We have 900 bases around the world. We're going broke. The purpose of Al-Qaeda was to attack us, invite us over there where they can target us. And they have been doing it. They have more attacks against us and the American interest per month than occurred in all the years before 9/11. But we're there occupying their land. And if we think that we can do that and not have retaliation, we're kidding ourselves. We have to be honest with ourselves. What would we do if another country, say China, did to us what we do to all those countries over there? So I would say a policy, a foreign policy that takes care of our national defense, that we're willing to get along with people and trade with people, as the founders advised. There's no authority in the Constitution to be the policeman of the world, and no nation building. Just remember, George Bush won the presidency on that platform in the year 2000, and I still think it's a good platform.
All right, let me let Senator Santorum respond, because I know you strongly disagree.
All right, everybody, we're going to hold it right here for more of this fight about foreign policy. It's from the presidential debate last night. The real Ron Paul taking on the biggest, stupidest lie in this society. All right, y'all, wrapping up the show. Got some more Ron Paul for you. I think this is the most important argument. That's why I talk about it pretty much every day on this show for years on end. As long as the myth stands that those planes came out of the clear blue sky, that they hate us because we're good and we're free and they're evil and Muslim, then this war is going to continue, and it's going to end up being the clash of civilizations that these liars and murderers keep trying to make it. Bin Laden tried to sell all of the people in his audience on the idea that we are at war with all of Islam, so they need to do like him. And and the war party on this side tries to pretend that it's Islam versus us in the West. And so they're on their own crusade against us to install Sharia law and the caliphate and all this BS. So we are on fighting the defensive jihad against them instead. And only truth can solve this. As long as, I don't know if the people have any say in it at all anymore. Maybe we don't. Maybe we're too far gone now. But it would be nice if we had a supermajority of people who understood the truth about how we got into this mess, namely occupying Saudi Arabia in order to enforce the blockade on Iraq in the 1990s and support for Israel, first and second and foremost. Then maybe we could change the policy. If reason could drown out the ignorant bloodlust and warmongering untruthfulness of the neoconservatives and their minor birds in politics and media in this country. The heroic Ron Paul is here last night in the presidential debate, standing up for the truth, the quite important and very important, and he explains why truth. And I'll note to you too, I'm sure you noticed, when he says, apply the golden rule. What if it was China occupying our country? Would we not be mad as hell and wanting to blow them up over it? Come on. And the audience does clap. They understand he's making sense. It's at one point he, you know, gets boos out of some of them, but it's progress being made. This is a populist right-wing audience here, Tea Party groups in the audience, and asking the questions.
Just remember, George Bush won the presidency on that platform in the year 2000, and I still think it's a good platform.
All right, let me let Senator Santorum respond, because I know you strongly disagree.
On your website on 9/11, you had a blog post that said, that basically blamed the United States for 9/11. On your website yesterday, you said that it was our actions that brought about the actions of 9/11. Now, Congressman Paul, that is irresponsible. A president of the United States running for someone who's running for the president of the United States in a Republican Party should not be parroting what Osama bin Laden said on 9/11. We are not being attacked, and we were not attacked because of our actions. We were attacked, as Newt talked about, because we have a civilization that is antithetical to the civilization of the jihadists. And they want to kill us because of who we are and what we stand for. And we stand for American exceptionalism. We stand for freedom and opportunity for everybody around the world. And I am not ashamed to do that.
30 seconds, Mr. Paul.
As long as this country follows that idea, we're going to be under a lot of danger. This whole idea that the whole Muslim world is responsible for this and they're attacking us because we're free and prosperous, that is just not true. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been explicit. They have been explicit, and they wrote and said that we attacked America because you had bases on our holy land in Saudi Arabia, you do not give Palestinians a fair treatment, and you have been bombing. I didn't say that. I'm trying to get you to understand what the motive was behind the bombing. At the same time, we had been bombing and killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis for 10 years. Would you be annoyed? If you're not annoyed,
you,
then there's some problem.
All right, we're going to stay on this subject. We have a question from the audience. Go ahead.
What would you add to the White House? What would you bring with you?
Congressman Paul.
If elected.
I'd bring a bushel basket full of common sense. And I would also bring a course in Austrian economics to teach the people the business cycle and why the Fed creates inflation and depressions and all our unemployment problems.
Governor Perry.
It's simple.
Yeah, right on. And I didn't see the whole debate because I just can't stand to sit there and listen to Newt Gingrich talk for a couple of minutes in a row. I just don't have the emotional constitution to bear it. I think it's my strength rather than my weakness, but maybe not. But I read on somebody's Facebook feed there that everybody else said, Newt said, I'm going to bring ballet and books that I like to read. And Rick Santorum said, I'm going to bring a bunch of extra beds for my family to sleep in or something. Ron Paul said, I'm going to bring common sense and Austrian economics. And by the way, that doesn't mean the economics of the state of Austria. That means the economics of a certain group of people who were from there and were economists and who perfected what ought to be American economics. Absolutely free markets. Government will not protect you from the most powerful evil corporations. Government is there to protect them from you. The Austrians say no bailouts, no corporate welfare, no warfare, but in absolute dire self-defense. And even then, I think most of them nowadays would want it to be privately and freely organized in voluntary fashion and in a decentralized way. And they are the ones who are right about why the economy goes up and down, good times, bad times. I remember an old Simpsons episode where Homer says, I'm going to go run and hide in the abandoned warehouse. And he goes in and everybody's working diligently, packing boxes with goods and shipping them out. And he says, darn economic recovery, But that was in like 1997 or something. Simpsons has been on for a while. Up and down it goes, up and down it goes. It's the same year always in Simpsons land, but sometimes the economy's good and sometimes not so much. But why is it like that? It's because of the manipulation of the currency, that's all. The manipulation of the money, the interest rates, the reserve ratios, the money supply by the Federal Reserve Bank and the Federal Reserve System, really, its board of directors up there, and the member banks. They, as Thomas Jefferson put it way back when, in criticizing Alexander Hamilton's plan to let the banks, in concert with the government, create their own currencies, he said, the bankers will inflate, or he said actually, by a process of inflation and then deflation, they will rob the people of the land their fathers conquered. They will take everything from the people who just fought for and won their independence. And so call it the Jeffersonian theory of the business cycle. You know, I asked Lou Rockwell about that one time, and he said, yeah, Jefferson, unlike Hamilton, who was just a self-interested Rick Santorum type, was actually passionately interested in economics and had read all the Spanish scholastics and whatever who got a lot of free market theory right and were the proto-Austrian school back then. You know, you can call Mises and Hayek the Jeffersonian theory of the business cycle, that when the amount of currency in circulation is manipulated by these people, they drive your prices up and then they collapse. Giant bubbles and then giant corrections and recessions. It's not the wild excesses of free market capitalism. It's the government central bank in cooperation with the most statist socialist institutions in our society, the bankers. Yeah, they're capitalists because they have private bank accounts and they sure deposit their bonuses and keep it. Oh, they're all about profits. But they don't face the risks of a capitalist marketplace. They're in it with the state, and they have been since the days of Hamilton, on and off. Jefferson thwarted them for a while. Andrew Jackson did for a little while, too. But for 100 years and running, they've had this central bank, which caused the Great Depression in the first place, the great collapse that led to it, and caused every war-associated boom and bust cycle throughout the 20th century and into the 21st. It's why you're broke today, the central bank. And, you know, you can just go to Mises.org and they got, 500,000 pages of written information for free up there by the brilliant minds on this. And this means, what this means is the Chicago school monetarists are wrong. And it means that the every other school Keynesian liberals are wrong. The Austrians are the ones who understand why the cycle goes boom and bust. Read it yourself. It ain't too difficult. Mises.org. We'll see y'all tomorrow.